Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. So often in our lives, we feel harried, overworked, burned out. We hunch over our computers at work. We neglect to check in on friends. Sarah Kaufman, dance critic for The Washington Post, urges us to slow down, look up from our gadgets, and see the grace all around us. It's everywhere, she says, in the pose of a great ballerina, in Roger Federer's groundstrokes, in the kindness of a helpful museum guard. She urges us to look around and find grace in others and in ourselves. This hour on Point, the power of grace. Later this hour, we'll speak with Judith Jamison, Artistic Director Emerita of the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater. But first, joining me from Washington is Sarah Kaufman, Pulitzer Prize-winning dance critic for The Washington Post. Her new book is called The Art of Grace, On Moving Well Through Life. Sarah, thank you so much for being here. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. It's great to be here.
So the book titled The Art of Grace. Give us a working definition. How do you define grace?
So that's something I thought a lot about. I think we all come to the word grace with different perceptions. And whether I was looking for the common denominator in the realms of physical, social, and spiritual grace. So whether we think of grace as divine love, easy and elegant movement, warm and welcoming behavior. To me, what underlies all of those three ideas is the sense of joyous giving, a kind of generosity, a polished generosity, if you will. So not our first flush of feeling, our disorganized thoughts, our exuberant energy, but a little bit more of a thoughtful process, a polished, refined, organized emotion, but still a warm and welcoming presence, whether it's in movement, whether it's in social behavior, whether you feel it in an atmosphere.
Mm. You distinguish between grace and etiquette. Tell us the difference.
So etiquette is more the detail-oriented rules of behavior. You know, the formalities. The fork goes on the left and the knife goes on the right. And who do you introduce first? And, do you stand when a lady walks into the room? I mean, those things were once very important and they are still important, but the idea of grace is really aimed at harmonious interactions. So it kind of goes beyond the formalities to our deeper connections with one another. What brings about a sense of ease in a setting? What brings about a sense of comfort? Who are the people that we feel comfortable being around because they are comfortable in their own skin? Mm. You know, the idea of grace is really creating warmth and appreciation and ease for others.
Mm. I love your descriptions in this book.
I have a
few that I pulled out. Here's one. Grace is made up of a poised and relaxed body, smooth and efficient motion, attentiveness, compassion. There is a contented silence to grace. It avoids what is loud and intrusive and what offends the eye. Can grace be learned or is it innate, Sarah Kaufman?
Well, I think it absolutely can be learned. And that's why I call this book The Art of Grace, because it is an art. It's a practice, if you will. It can be a daily habit. You know, the people who are the most graceful have a habit of gratitude, of being warm, of thinking before they speak, of self-control, which lends grace that kind of quietness, that unobtrusiveness. Mm. you know, you could think of it as control or you could think of it as polish. Mm. But it is something that can be learned. And what I aim to do in this book is provide a lot of examples from different areas of life where we can learn that grace does exist in films, in a rock club, among strippers, in a kitchen, in a concert hall, on the street corner, all kinds of areas where if we pay attention and we are really aware of our surroundings, we can see these moments of graceful interaction. And if we pay attention to them, we can copy them and we can embody them ourselves.
You say in the book that humans are hardwired to appreciate grace. Give us some examples of this, of what you speak.
So we are mammals. We are primates. And back in our early, early evolution, you know, our brains were created to be aware of movement. Not only to be aware of movement, but to move. So that's the reason we have a brain. It's 99% a motor system. That's what neuroscientists will tell you. We're meant to move. We're meant to perceive movement. And not only are we then capable of perceiving graceful movement, and that strikes a lot of, you know, it rings a lot of bells in our pleasure zones. I mean, we're just, you know, I've talked to evolutionary scientists who kind of put forward a theory, and it's a theory, it's hard to prove, but the theory that, you know, as primates swinging through trees, like you can look at orangutans now, this sense of smooth, connected movement was essential for our survival. Mm. So that's one element you can kind of lay in as a theory of why we respond to what is smooth and connected and elegant in movement. But emotions are also part of movement. You know, it's part of what we pick up from one another. Emotions kind of start out as movement, in fact, in some theories. You know, we're tense, and so our bodies tense up. We're scared, or we're comfortable, and so we relax, and our bodies relax. And we pick up on these signals that we give to one another. Our brains are wired to do that. It's how we connect, and so a graceful presentation forges a deeper and a more easy connection. Mm.
One of the models for human grace that you talk about in the book is actor Cary Grant, who you say embodied liquid smoothness, not only in his movements, but also in his interactions on screen. Here he is in the 1940 film The Philadelphia Story. C.K. Dexter Haven, played by Cary Grant, confronts his former wife, whom he calls Red, played by the great Katharine Hepburn.
Red, you could be the finest woman on this earth. I'm contemptuous of something inside of you. You either can't help or make no attempt to. Your so-called strength, your prejudice against weakness, your blank intolerance.
Is that all?
That's the gist of it. Because you'll never be a first-class human being or a first-class woman until you've learned to have some regard for human frailty.
What makes Cary Grant graceful, Sarah?
I love that clip. I love that movie. What makes him graceful? He had the outer and the inner qualities. So he had started out in his performing career as an acrobat. He was a vaudeville performer. He had a sense of his body in space. He had that quick reflex, the being attuned to his fellow performers that you need as an acrobat. And he brought that elegance and that quick kind of movement reflex to his roles on screen. Mm. But he also had the inner qualities of compassion and understanding. And his, you know, that is written into this role that he played in The Philadelphia Story, where he talks to Katharine Hepburn, as we just heard, about having an understanding heart, having embracing human frailty and weakness and vulnerability and not being so rigid and cold, which is her character. But he also carried that off the screen. His colleagues have written very movingly about his generosity to them. He contributed to a lot of humanitarian causes. In fact, he donated his salary from the Philadelphia Story to the British war effort.
Mm, right, right.
You know, he stood up for Ingrid Bergman when she was being viciously attacked in the press and all over for her love affair with Roberto Rossellini.
So it was on screen and off screen that there was,
exactly.
There was a grace.
The inside and the out.
You talked about emotional grace. I think of many figures, one being Nelson Mandela. I wanted to play this clip, Oprah Winfrey speaking to the former South African president in 2000, asking him why he was not bitter. He'd spent 27 years in prison in his fight against apartheid. Here he is.
I hated oppression. And when I think about the past, the type of things they did, I feel angry. Our emotion said the white minority is an enemy. We must never talk to them. But our brain said, if you don't talk to this man, your country will go up in flames.
Mm. That to me, grace in motion, grace in action, grace in every word.
Exactly. And that polish that is so essential to grace, you know, he was able to distance himself from his raging emotions. You know, our emotions tell us about hatred, but our actions have to be different. And our actions come from a place of understanding and seeing the bigger picture. And that is exactly what Nelson Mandela did so beautifully.
We're going out here with music from Fred Astaire, the Can't Take That Away From Me from the 1937 film Shall We Dance. We're talking about noticing grace around us this hour and finding it in ourselves. You can join the conversation. What's your daily application of grace? Is there someone whose grace you try to emulate? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Much more after this break, including your calls, many of them. Stick with us. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
The way you hold your knife, the way we danced till three, the way you've changed my life. No, no, they can't take that away from me. No, they can't take that away from me.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking with Sarah Kaufman, Washington Post dance critic, about her new book, The Art of Grace, on moving well through life. Many callers graciously waiting to get on the air here. Let's go to some Beverly in Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Beverly. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Fine. Thank you. Go ahead.
I am so thrilled with this topic. I can't tell you because I literally feel that I've been thinking about grace all my life. I remember watching TV, watching dance perhaps on television when I was a very, very young child. And the word grace was used. And I remember asking my aunt, what was it? What did it mean? And I think it was because it was probably said in a positive tone. But the thing is, I realized that I had studied it or tried to be it throughout my life. That only came to me recently. I'll be 69 on Monday. But, you know, grace, it's you know, in the religious sense, is bestowing a blessing on someone. And I think when humans are involved in it, whether it's physical or whether it is emotional or spiritual or moral, it's also bestowing a blessing.
Beverly, thank you. It's a great point. Sarah Kaufman, let me bring that up with you. For many people, grace or divine grace is associated with religion. And indeed, you've talked to Christians and Jewish and Muslim religious scholars in your book about how they see grace. What do they say?
Exactly. And I love Beverly's definition of bestowing. And that's actually very close to what the original Greek for grace was, this idea of charis, which the Latins then turned into gratis, which is how we got the word grace. And it came from the word for gift, as in bestowing something to somebody, giving something to somebody, and that sense of reaching out and extending yourself. So that idea of, you know, most religions have a kind of a core value of compassion, of the universe being generous and loving to you if you'll only open yourself up to it. This is in Christianity, of course, in Judaism, in the Muslim faith, in Hinduism. I mean, it's kind of a universal drive that we have, and it comes from, I think we access it through gratitude. I think all these religions teach us that gratitude for what we are given, for what is bestowed to us, is a way to achieve grace, to achieve equanimity, to be more at peace because we see what is given to us. We see what is so beautiful around us.
Thank you for that call. Let's go to Ramey in Jamestown, Kentucky. Ramey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. Go ahead.
My comment is I'm a photographer and video producer, and as well as a single parent. And I'm constantly fighting the battle of between devices and real life because you're seeing things through a lens or through a smartphone. And one thing that I have love about that is that you can see life through a different angle, as well as my child's life. But you're in a constant battle as well as, do I enjoy this moment in real life through your own eyes or through a lens? And my child has helped me to really appreciate grace in the sense that he does things unprompted, unasked for, whether it's a note that says, I love you, Dad, or doing something out of the kindness of his heart, because a child's love, I've noticed, and a child's grace is so, and it's in such an infant stage that they don't understand, you know, they're not doing it for self-progress. They're not doing it for any other enticement other than to make you happy. And so not only does he benefit me in the actions that he makes, when I notice what he does outside of the lens of a camera, but he motivates me to do that for other people because it's a sense of empathy, I guess, is what that develops. Because
that's an interesting point, Ramey. Thank you. The innocence of a child's grace, Sarah Kaufman.
That is a fantastic point. And empathy is exactly what that's all about, that connection. And it's an endless loop. You know, the baby smiling at the father responding with this joyful smile back. It's what we can do to one another as adults moving through the world to try to conjure up that warm greeting, just hello, you know, smiling at someone. When you walk down the street and someone gives you a smile, it feels great, you know, and we have that capacity. We can pass that on. Children have not yet learned to be wary, you know, to be guarded. So they just give that freely. They just give that joy, that beauty, that smile, that in the moment awareness of the people around them and that, you know, friendly connection, that joyous connection.
Thanks so much for the call. There are many examples of grace on stage. Very obvious one here at the 2009 MTV Video Music Awards. Kanye West interrupted Taylor Swift's acceptance speech for Best Video by a female artist to say that Beyonce had one of the best music videos of all time. And then later that night, Beyonce shared the limelight when she was called up on stage for Best Video of the Year. Here's that.
I remember being 17 years old, up for my first MTV award with Destiny's Child, and it was one of the most exciting moments in my life. So I'd like for Taylor to come out and have her moment.
Another example of grace right there on stage.
Absolutely.
Let me bring in another voice to the conversation, Sarah Kaufman. Joining me now from New York is a woman who embodies grace and who's helped many others achieve it. Judith Jamison, Artistic Director Emerita of the Alvin Ailey Dance Theater. She joined the company as a dancer in 1965, and she became its Artistic Director in 1989, a role she held for 21 years. Judith, so great to speak with you again.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. We reached out to you for
Good.
This program because we felt that you really embody what we think of as a graceful person. You're a choreographer, a dancer. I'm curious, what does grace mean to you?
Well, because I was raised in the church, grace immediately is the gift of God. Mm. It comes from God. It's grace. It's God's grace that I'm living and breathing, that we're all here, that I'm looking at a beautiful sky, that I woke up this morning, all of that. And the older I get, of course, that becomes even more evident. And the experiences, the small experiences that we have, someone was mentioning just saying hello or just appreciating the person that's next to you or even getting in an elevator and not having everybody looking down at their cell phone and saying good morning.
Right.
Even that is a way of grace. And it's obvious as a dancer, you hope you're being graceful or whatever the choreography calls for. But the beauty of my relationship with Mr. Ailey is what was spiritually spent in rehearsals. The actual performance is wonderful. That's sharing with an audience. What Alvin shared with all of us on a very intimate level, that is spiritual grace. That an artist can speak to you without words, can speak to you with movement, and then you produce something that can be called graceful, but that graces the heart so that it becomes an unforgettable experience for an audience and for the dancer.
Well, I remember interviewing you a few years ago in Washington when you were being honored at the Kennedy Center Awards. And what struck me was not only the fluidity of your movements as a dancer, as a person, but your internal grace. I'm curious, is grace something that you try to cultivate or is it just in you?
Well, I think it has to be cultivated, but also I'm thinking of the physicality of grace.
Yes.
That my mother knew that she had a kid at the age of 6 years old that was going to be gangly, long-legged, and skinny. And she and not very graceful. She didn't say that to me, but she put me in dance school immediately. Mm. Immediately. Because she knew that gangly girl needed to have some help as far as that physicality was concerned. And I guess she was right. Hmm.
So when you help dancers achieve grace on stage, are you also helping them find grace within?
Absolutely. If it isn't, I ask them to approach who they are as people, not as dancers, as people. Because Mr. Ailey used to say that to us all the time, that you have to recognize that human being, that heart, that spirit that is you. Not necessarily the physicality that's you. Because if you recognize your internal spirit, your internal grace, then it will manifest itself in what you have to do externally, especially if you're as well-trained as an Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater dancer is. The technique is there, but it's got to come from inside first to the outside, as we all think, don't we, when we think about beauty and grace, that it's got to be internalized first so it can show itself on the outside.
Well, you are indeed full of it. Judith Jamison, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. What a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. Judith Jamison is Artistic Director Emerita of the Alvin Ailey Dance Theater. She speaks with us from New York. Let's go back to the phones. Rob is in Franklin, Kentucky. Rob, welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
I fully agree with your panelists that grace can be taught. I was raised in the South. I was raised from a very early age that you say yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. I don't care if you're 18 or 80. I will always address you as that. I open doors. I hold doors. I help people with their groceries. And grace goes far beyond what you would think as far as a ballet or a dance or even music, although those all, you know, tie in. I mean, I'm looking outside of my window right now, and I see grace in the wind blowing the trees. It's a matter of mind, and it's an attitude, and it very well can be taught.
Wonderful comment. Matter of mind. Rob, thank you so much. Let me play a couple more examples of grace. Sarah Kaufman, here's the documentary series for the clothing maker Citizens of Humanity, where Mikhail Baryshnikov talks about grace, about discovering his love for dance.
I didn't question my impulses. I really wanted to do it. I knew from the very beginning I can do it. I it's indescribable. You could ask why a cello player loves to play this instrument. I'm playing my instrument, my body.
I'm playing my instrument in my body. Here's Roger Federer doing the same, currently the number 3 ranked male tennis player. In 2013, talked to CNN about how exciting it was early in his tournament days to be matched against people he'd only ever seen on television.
My favorite time, in a way, was when I was coming up and about, just because I was playing against a guy from TV, and I was like, really, am I playing against Pete Sampras or Andre Agassi or, you know, those kind of guys, Carlos Moya, Tim Henman, you know, you name it, and I was like, wow, this guy's got such beautiful volleys, or his forehand's amazing, or his serve is outrageous, I've never seen a guy return like this, and that you're on the same court is like an honor.
Sarah Kaufman, what do you see in the grace of an athlete?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I write a lot about Roger Federer in my book. And in fact, I spoke with the director of the New York City Ballet about who was his icon of grace. Peter Martins, the director of the New York City Ballet, said it's Roger Federer, not the dancers that he, you know, the legions of dancers that he has seen. It was Roger Federer who stood out, as I think he does for so many of us, because he's got that flow. You know, he's got what Federer has is a finish to his moves. And that's so important in the eye and how we perceive movement is the finish. There's not a jerkiness at the end, you know, between one step and the next. There's a continuum. It's like a satin scarf blowing in the wind. You know, it's just easy and silky. Mm-hmm. And even with the battle that he's going through on the tennis court, you know, he's trying to win. He's trying to score points. He's got that finish, that continuum of movement, that kind of tap dance, a flow, buoyancy, a real buoyancy. And it just must be his style of movement. I mean, it clearly helps him. He's a very winning tennis player. But there are other winning tennis players that don't have as much grace. So does it convey a competitive advantage? Maybe yes, maybe no. It registers in our mind where we store all of the manifestations of beauty that move us. And we remember that so well. We will remember Roger Federer for ages, just like we will remember Julius Erving, you know, even though he didn't rack up the points that a LeBron James perhaps does with his greater kind of aggression and large-scale movement. Mm. Julius Erving had that airiness, that ease.
And Joe DiMaggio, who you talk about in your book, who is an extremely graceful player, but socially quite awkward.
Yeah, I call it the problem of Joe DiMaggio. He kind of cut it in two. He was very graceful on the field. I mean, you know, people talked about the way he would skim the field, the way he just rose up in the air to make a catch, the way he just got from, you know, from batting the ball to first base kind of in the blink of an eye. You never saw him. He just appeared. It almost looked like he was in slow motion. He was so graceful. Mm-hmm. But off the field, he was very tense. He kept to himself. You know, he didn't have that givingness. I think his celebrity was difficult for him, a difficult burden for him, as it can be for some people. Others seem to bear it more lightly. For Joe DiMaggio, that was not the case, and he was very guarded off the field.
We're talking about finding grace in others and in ourselves this hour. Sarah Kaufman is my guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning dance critic for The Washington Post. Her new book is The Art of Grace, on moving well through life. You can read an excerpt from the book at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join the conversation, who taught you how to fill your life with grace? Do you think of grace in the context of religion? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going out here with Beyoncé singing her 2009 hit, Halo. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Everywhere I'm looking now, I'm surrounded by your grace. Baby, I can see your halo. You know you're my saving grace. You're everything I need and more. It's written all over your face. Baby, I can feel your halo.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking to Washington Post dance critic Sarah Kaufman about her new book, The Art of Grace, on moving well through life. And you can join the conversation. Do you worry that society has become coarse? What do we lose when we lose grace among us? A lot of listener response on this from Twitter. Perry says, grace is what happens when self gets out of the way, leaving a space for her sister, generosity. Here's an example of grace toward the end of life. In August, former President Jimmy Carter, at age 90, spoke about the cancer that had spread to his brain. He said that he was at peace with his diagnosis.
I've had a wonderful life. I've had thousands of friends, and I've had an exciting and adventurous and gratifying existence. So I was surprisingly at ease, much more so than my wife was.
Our political discourse seems pretty coarse, but there have been moments of grace. Here's President Obama delivering the eulogy on June 26th for Reverend Clementa Pinckney, who was gunned down in his Charleston church along with eight others in a Bible study group.
Blinded by hatred, the alleged killer could not see the grace surrounding Reverend Pinckney and that Bible study group. The light of love that shone as they opened the church doors and invited a stranger to join in their prayer circle.
Let's go to the phones. Rob in Plainfield, New Hampshire. Hi, Rob. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. My comment is in the light of National Caregiver Month, and I think a lot of the times grace occurs when no one else is watching. And for my family, in my case, I'd just like to make a comment on my father, who is a primary caregiver for my mother, who's suffering from Alzheimer's. And I know the grace that he displays at 2:30 in the morning when she can't sleep and he has to care for her. And so I just want to thank all those caregivers out there across the nation and know that that grace has not gone unnoticed and is the most highest form of grace, in my opinion.
So Rob, thank you. Thank you very much. Grace is when no one is watching. Thank you very much.
That's absolutely beautiful. You know, what's so exciting about the idea of grace is that it encapsulates kind of everything. It's like a worldview. It's how you are physically, how you are socially, how you are spiritually. It's all connected in this givingness, in this quiet, as we just heard, when no one's looking. How do you behave? What do you give to the person you pass on the street? How do you feel comfort? How do you give comfort? You know, our presence has such an impact on the person next to us, on the person we live with, on the person we stand in the elevator with, on the person we work with. And how is your presence, your full presence, physical, social, wrapped up in this idea of generosity?
It's a great call, Rob. Sarah, you also mentioned grace in the arm movements and the demeanor of a guard at the Guggenheim Museum in New York, the unscripted choreography of a chef in a well-run kitchen. I mean, it's everywhere if you look for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that it's almost on the verge of extinction in our conversations, in our discourse. You know, we don't talk about it very much, not nearly as much as it was talked about in earlier years, you know, in the Renaissance, in the colonial times, in the 1900s in this country, when there was such a sense of striving and of bettering ourselves. What I wanted to do was bring it back into the conversation because, as our wonderful callers have brought up, there are these moments of grace in our lives every day. And as one of the religious representatives I spoke with in my book, a priest, said, his idea of grace, his idea of a saint was someone who saw every moment of the day as a moment of grace, as something to appreciate, something to be aware of, something to savor.
Here's Russell in Brookfield, Connecticut. Russell, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Hi. I'm impressed by the use of the dance and that kind of thing as the grace in dance and so forth as mostly a metaphor. It's a grace that we can admire and enjoy, but also see it as a way to move through life, and that the grace comes from, as the previous caller said, the way people move through illness, move through trauma, etc. Should we be should we make a real distinction between grace as that metaphor, grace as something we enjoy, versus the grace of that supererogatory type of behavior and the way we can move through the really tough parts of life and how we treat each other more generally?
Russell, thank you. Sarah Kaufman?
Well, I think whether we're religious or not, many of us relate to the idea of grace as a comfort, a form of love, a way to get through difficulty, you know, because it can be painful at times to be human. And as someone I spoke to in research for my book said, if we didn't experience the pain, we wouldn't experience the comfort. You know, the pain opens us up to receive comfort, and the comfort feels so good, whether it's someone taking care of you in the middle of the night, someone helping you find your keys when you've tripped over a curb and dumped your purse into the gutter, somebody holding the door open for you when you're struggling to get through with your tote bag and you've just broken the heel off your shoe and you got a cup of coffee in one hand. Those moments of comfort are just like, wow. And it almost doesn't matter if it's delivered in a theater performance by a beautiful dancer who kind of soothes you with her leaps across the stage and sort of carries you sympathetically along with her. Or is it a guard at a museum, you know, ushering you into an exhibit with a beautiful sweep of his hand and a welcoming smile? It's both grace. Both of those are grace.
You cite passages, Sarah Kaufman, in your book from literature about grace. Would you read one? Set up this scene for us. I think the first one is The Great Gatsby.
Yes. So this is, I think, what makes Jay Gatsby truly great. The narrator of The Great Gatsby, Nick Carraway, finds himself at a party given by Jay Gatsby, but he hasn't yet met Gatsby. And Nick Carraway is feeling very ill at ease. He doesn't know who the host is. He's kind of isolated. He's sort of a fish out of water. And he sort of complains about this a little bit to a man who comes up to speak with him. Well, it turns out that's Gatsby himself. So you could expect, you know, Gatsby would be a little frosty in response. Well, here's what he does. What Nick Carraway says is that Gatsby smiled understandingly, much more than understandingly. It was one of those rare smiles with a quality of eternal reassurance in it that you may come across four or five times in life. It faced, or seemed to face, the whole external world for an instant, and then concentrated on you with an irresistible prejudice in your favor. It understood you just so far as you wanted to be understood, believed in you as you would like to believe in yourself, and assured you that it had precisely the impression of you that, at your best, you hoped to convey.
That's fantastic. You have one more that I want you to read, from The Bell Jar.
Yes, so this was another kind of a similar moment of ill at ease-ness when Sylvia Plath, the writer of this wonderful book, is recounting a time when she was a college student and she attended a fancy luncheon with the woman who had endowed her college scholarship. On the table was a small bowl of water, Plath writes, with a few cherry blossoms floating in it, and I thought it must be some clear sort of Japanese after-dinner soup, and ate every bit of it, including the crisp little blossoms. Mrs. Guinea never said anything, and it was only much later, when I told a debutante I knew at college about the dinner, that I learned what I had done. So what I love about that is the silence. You know, Mrs. Guinea just processed that moment and moved on. She didn't stuff it up her guest's nose that she had committed a faux pas. She didn't raise an eyebrow. She didn't let on at all that anything was amiss. She simply let her guest continue thinking that she had done the right thing. And what a graceful gesture that is.
Clifford from Detroit, Michigan. You're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Yeah, hi to the panel. My grace is from my parents who taught me to be helpful in humanity. And then later on in life, my grace comes from my stepmother who taught me how to be classy with grace. And it led me into, you know, I'm a cook, and this is my grace here in the kitchen cooking. And been seeing other people who smile once they, you know, eat my food, you know.
That's wonderful. Clifford, thank you. What a great call. Thank you so much from Detroit. Now let's go to Fairfield, Connecticut. Tommy's on the line. Tommy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My comment before, actually I have two, but we were talking about athletes. I one night was washing the dishes, and in the darkened window over the sink in front of me with the TV behind me, I watched Derek Jeter turn a double play in mirror image, and to see it that way broke it down into really like the Zen masters at play. Mm. Truly, truly graceful acts when they do things like that.
Indeed.
But my real point is that I've been living homeless in my car for over a year now, and it's dignity that is the word for the day whenever I go into public to meet people, to dress myself, to make sure I'm washed and changed, and how I keep my car and how I keep my appearance with others. Grace and dignity go hand in hand. And usually helping stranded motorists, other homeless men. Somebody gives me a 20, break it in half, give the guy next to me 10, pass it on, even if it's just a couple of bucks, a guy who needs gas more than I do.
Tommy, thank you. Thank you very much. Good luck to you, Sarah.
That is so moving. That's so beautifully said. That dignity and grace do go hand in hand. I think treating each other with grace gives us our dignity, gives other people their dignity. It's a dignity to be graceful, and it recognizes the dignity in other people when you treat them with grace.
Let's get to some grace in the kitchen. That caller reminded me of Julia Child, who was the star of many cooking shows, the first of which aired in 1963. Tremendous grace. Here she is trying to flip a potato pancake.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
Clifford, so you awesome. And Julia, isn't that great, Sarah?
Yeah. It's so awesome because she, you don't have to be a trained ballerina. You don't have to be Derek Jeter or Roger Federer to be graceful. You can be clumsy in the kitchen and just laugh it off. Your guests, if you're cooking for somebody, as the fellow who was a cook just related in his phone call, they just want to be taken care of and they want to see you enjoying what you're doing. So it's not a burden to them, you know, that you're working so hard for them. And that's what I love about Julia Child, is she brought that joy into what she did. She wasn't locking down every detail and, you know, fussing over everything. She could make a flub on TV, scoop it up, smile at her audience, and make it all
and
look easy.
Move on, that's right. Erin from Charleston, South Carolina, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment very quickly. I'm a nurse and a new one at that. And I just wanted to say that I think that one of the reasons that my profession constantly has one of the highest ratings in terms of satisfaction is that we get to give grace every day to our patients. I think that's very satisfying for people, despite long hours and sometimes gross things that we do. We give that grace to our patients, and it feels really good.
Wonderful. Erin, thank you so much. Here's Pablo in Weymouth, Massachusetts. Pablo, welcome to the program. Hi.
Yes, I was raised in a Christian environment, a Christian family, and early as a young person, I learned that grace is undeserving love and unconditional love. So now that I'm a dad of two, I find myself a lot of times giving to my kids, not because they've been behaving great, but because I love them. Sometimes they're not the greatest, but it's not because they deserve something. They just deserve my unconditional love.
Pablo, thank you. Thank you very much. We're just down to our last couple of minutes here, Sarah Kaufman. In your book, you talk about modern society so often descending now into crude gracelessness. Is there hope for a resurgence of grace?
You know, we all have to really work at this to kind of elevate things. I think that what is happening is we're in the pendulum swing of, you know, things were very kind of tightly controlled in earlier years as far as behavior and so forth. And there's always going to be an adjustment, you know, with a next generation. And I think that's what we're in, where honesty is a little overvalued, you know, letting it all hang out, sharing our feelings. That can be a bit much. You know, we don't want to know everybody's deepest feelings all the time because that can be hurtful and it's not always productive. Brusqueness and bluntness can really add stress. You know, I think that we do need to get back to a little bit of self-discipline, a little bit of self-control, and mostly thinking of others, feeling what other people are feeling, putting ourselves in another person's position, and trying to see the world from another person's point of view. Mm-hmm. And that requires taking a step back, taking a breath, slowing down, you know, taking some time to understand before reacting.
I'll end with a quote from your book. The graceful person is an image of our ideal selves, the embodiment of the dream we have of existing easily in the world. This is why we're so moved by graceful people who carry themselves with ease and unconsciousness, who seem at peace. Sarah Kaufman, thank you for this beautiful book and for being with us today.
Thank you so very much, Jane. It's been a pleasure.
Sarah Kaufman is dance critic for The Washington Post and author of the new book, The Art of Grace, on moving well through life. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.